The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.
Love. Courage. Truth. Glenn Beck.
You know, we have to start comparing ourselves to ourselves yesterday and stop comparing ourselves to the things that we see on television or on Facebook, because it's a lie. David and Louise loved each other. Oh, and they loved Elvis. It was clear from their family Facebook page. You see the pictures on their Facebook page, their three vow renewal ceremonies. They had a tradition of going to the Elvis Chapel in Las Vegas. David, Louise, and their 13 children. Oh, and the king. All look very happy in these photos. Every Facebook page lies. Sometimes just by omission. Sometimes you're not getting the whole picture. Sometimes you're getting a complete fraud. Today, you're looking at the Turpin's images in a whole different light. And now they look dark and twisted. If you don't know who the Turpins are, let me tell you. Sunday, authorities responded to a 9/11 call by one of David and Louise's daughters. The daughter frantically explained on this stolen phone that she had escaped the family home and begged the police to come and rescue her and her siblings, who were starving and chained to their beds. The girl claimed to be 17 years old. When police actually saw her, they didn't believe her. They thought she was 10. But she is 17. They found the girl's 12 brothers and sisters chained, padlocked to their beds. They were filthy. They were emaciated. The children, they thought, were all under the age of 15. But they weren't. The children ranged in age from 2 to 29. They were so famished that they were shocked. The deputies were shocked to find out that 7 of them were adults. David and Louise were unable to immediately provide a logical reason to why their children might have been, you know, chained to their bed. I'm trying to think. As I read that this morning, I thought, what would the logical reason be to chain your children to the bed? But they apparently had none. The children were taken to the hospital. They're in the care of Child Protective Services. The Turpins were arrested. They were booked on charges of torture and child endangerment. We're at a time when we have so much information about almost everything, except what is true. In the age of social media, it is getting more and more difficult to know what's real and what isn't, because we all have the ability to edit and manipulate our own narratives. You know, I don't know if you saw the movie about P.T. Barnum, The Greatest Showman, but I left that movie and I thought, I want to read about P.T. Barnum. So I went, and there's just not a lot of good books about him. The one that gets the highest ratings, the one that is supposedly the best, the author was P.T. Barnum. How could I possibly believe anything that P.T. Barnum said about himself? He was trying to give an image of himself that wasn't necessarily reality. And isn't that what we're doing with Facebook? Because of Facebook, Turpin's friends and family had no idea that they were hideous monsters who were torturing their children. What's really frightening is they're not the only ones. This isn't going to be the first time. It's not going to be the last time. We'll continue to be shocked by the dichotomy of how people present themselves and what the actual truth is. How many people are we finding out are monsters? The Turpin family provides us with a horrible cautionary tale today. Something that we all need to understand as we move forward. And it is just really simple, but somehow or another, at times, it controls our life. It even controls our own attitude and self-worth because we forget that when it comes to social media, you're not seeing the full picture, and sometimes you're not even anywhere close to the truth.
It's Tuesday, January 16th. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
So I got up this morning and I saw this Turpin story and my first thought was, what the hell's wrong with us? What happens to human beings? What is happening to us? And I guess nothing. We're not getting worse. If anything, maybe we're getting better. But this was, this was the way of the world when, you know, in the Dark Ages and when people were not living on top of each other, this kind of stuff, you know, happened a lot. We just hide it now and hopefully we're getting better.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, hopefully it's not quite as common. But I mean, I guess these stories probably did happen. We're hearing about them now. It's weird that when the story first broke, you think to yourself, oh yeah, that's like one of those, like this story or that story or that story. And you're like, why do I have other examples of this?
Yeah.
I shouldn't have any other examples to point to. This should be a one-time thing, but it's not. These things do exist.
It's not something that is new.
No.
I mean, you know, the story of St. Nicholas, one of the reasons why he was deemed a saint is because of the miracle of the four boys. I can't remember exactly what it's called. There were these boys that went from their house. They were supposed to go to their uncle's house or something, and they were halfway there. They stopped at this inn, and this guy who ran the inn said, oh yeah, you guys can stay here. You can stay here for free. I just need some help downstairs. Went downstairs. He killed them. He ground them up into sausage and he was making meat pies for the people who came to his place. That's what the meat was. It wasn't cats. It was kids. St. Nicholas was the bishop of the town, knew those children. He went on a search for the kids, stopped at this inn, sensed that something was really wrong, went down into the basement, saw the condition. He was canonized because they say that he rose, he assembled them back together somehow or another and brought them back from the dead. I don't know about that part of the story. That's the kind of stuff that, you know, people have been doing to people forever.
Yeah. You know, that's a weird, dark part of humanity, isn't it? And I guess, you know, it's hard to understand how you could get to that position. Like, first you have to make that decision. It's like, you know, the first person who ever drank milk. You're like, what was the decision that led to that?
Milk.
Who was like, hey, I'll suck off clams. That cow thing.
I think clams or oysters or lobsters are like, what? You know, somebody had to try to eat a spider at one point. I mean, a big hairy spider. And they were like, oh, okay, that's not good. Don't know.
Right. And decisions, like, yeah, when don't you know. Make that first decision, it influences the rest of your decisions.
Yes.
And it doesn't catch on with humanity.
Yes.
It seems like that's, most of us are not enslaving people. And that's really positive. But like you start that. That family at some point made a decision for that first kid to be chained up in a room. And that lasted for how long and how many more people were affected by it? They continued to go down that road. Maybe they didn't think they could reverse it. Maybe they're so psychotic that that's all they wanted kids for. We're going to find out a lot
it's
about this story.
Weird because there's all these pictures of them happy.
Yeah.
And some of the kids were out. They were seen, you know, as early as a couple of weeks ago, one of the older ones driving a car going out. I mean, the fear of what would happen, I guess, to the rest of the family must have been incredible.
Yeah, yeah. You hit on an interesting point in the monologue, because I think most people are just going to take this to, you know, how horrible the situation is, which is true. But, I mean, we take Facebook pictures seriously for some reason, right? It's the same way my wife, every time a new product comes out and that she wants to buy, she comes and shows me the testimonial page of their website. Like, to me, there's no impact at all from a testimonial page from a website, because I know you have an incentive of this company. They're trying to sell it to me. Of course, they found the 9 people who really like the product, or they made them up, right? Like, that's how I internalize that. And I think a lot of people do, same thing with Facebook. I don't know. I look at Facebook and people are, you know, smiling photos. And I think internally for most people, you just be like, oh, wow, they must have a really good life. What they are all happy. They're having these wonderful times together. What a great story. And we all know that at some level, not to the level where you're chaining your children to the beds, hopefully, but we all at some point, we don't post the really sad pictures. We don't take pictures when people are mourning. We don't take pictures when people are fighting and are having troubled times. You take pictures when things are happy. You post them. You are doing the same editing bubble stuff we complain about with the news, right? Like, you're only exposing people to the happy points of your life. And the fact that that could work on people to the level to separate a family from happiness to kids chained up to their beds shows how powerful that is. I mean, their own relatives weren't even questioning it.
Well, there's something wrong with the relatives, too. I mean, the grandparents live in West Virginia. They said they hadn't seen the kids in 5 years, hadn't seen the family in 5 years. But they said, you know, the last couple of years, they've talked to the family lots of times. However, never the grandchildren. Well, what? I mean, doesn't that strike you as weird that you have grandchildren from 2 to 29? And over a 2-year period, you've talked to people in the house, but never the children?
It is weird, but I mean, family dynamics can be strange sometimes. Sometimes there's fights, there's long-term battles, there's, you know, there's all sorts of stuff that happens in families where it's possible that that could happen. You'd think, though, there'd be some indication of trouble.
And it's frightening as well. If you look at the aerial shots of this house, these houses are, you know, not acres apart. They're right on top of each other. Neighbors said they didn't even know that, some of them didn't even know that there were 13 kids in there. What? What? Wow. You didn't even know. What the one neighbor said they thought it was weird, but I think 2 weeks ago she went outside at night, and it was like 9 or 10 o'clock at night, and the kids were, there were 4 of them. And they were all kneeling down in the grass together, and they were all just kind of rolling around in the grass. And the mother was standing in the back watching over them. And she cried over the fence, you know, the neighbor did, said, "Hey, hey, guys." And the kids kind of looked at her and then just kind of froze. And the mother didn't even recognize the neighbor saying anything. And she said it was just really odd, but she didn't think anything about it. It just, you know, it's weird that they were out at 9:30 at night, but, you know, and their reaction is weird.
Well, we just have no, I mean, people on my street could have, you know, entire tribes in their basement, and I wouldn't even know. I mean, you don't interact with your neighbors like you used to. I mean, we always throw back to the times where you used to be able to just let your kids out and they would go around the neighborhood, and now we'd be terrified to do those things, right? Like, you'd never want that to happen. Because we're sort of somewhat crazy, right? Like, the crime rates are all lower. There's no reason to, we're overprotective now with our kids. But part of the reason why it felt okay is because you knew everybody in the neighborhood. You knew all the other parents. You knew that they would look out for your kids. You knew that they would feel okay punishing them if they did something wrong.
I think it was also more than that, though. We thought we all had the same values.
Yeah.
We were wrong. You know what I mean?
We're totally misled.
Right. We were totally misled, but we all thought we had the same basic values. And so we didn't question the parents because we thought, oh, well, you know, parents are parents. they believe the same thing we do, and they're going to make sure. No. And I don't know if anything has changed, because, I mean, I grew up in the Pacific Northwest, so, you know. But I remember me and my friends going over to my friend's house, and my friends, we were all embarrassed for the kid whose parents were hippies and were always stoned. And we were like, oh, your mom and dad stoned again? Yeah. And they would be like, you know, hey, kids, how are things? You know? And, I mean, my parents didn't know that I was going over to, you know, I happened to be running with a group of decent kids that were all like, okay, the stoners are here. But we all turned out to be stoners. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And part of it is because our parents were radically different. My parents would not have been cool with that. But my parents just thought everybody's parents were the same. They didn't realize, oh, that's the 60s hippie family. Yep. Mm. How was your sleep last night? Did you get a good night's sleep? Did you wake up feeling refreshed, feeling good? I want to talk to you about Casper. Casper is a mattress that will really help you feel good at night. Casper mattress has a unique combination of foams that provides the right pressure relief and the comfort, so you'll feel balanced when you get up in the morning. Plus, it's made of breathable material, so you don't wake up in the middle of the night, you know, having to throw off the blankets because it's so hot. I had a Tempur-Pedic mattress. Oh my gosh, I hated that thing. I hated it because it was a billion degrees every night. Casper has come up with a foam mattress that is comfortable, supportive, and it breathes. Casper, try it out in your own home for 100 nights, risk-free. They'll ship it to you in a little compact box. You can just take it in and open it up and boom, there's the mattress. But if you don't love it, you don't have to put it back in that tiny little box. They'll come and pick it up and refund every single penny, no questions asked. They want you to have a great night's sleep. Try Casper in your own home for 100 nights. Go to casper.com/Beck. Use the promo code Beck and save $50 on the purchase of select mattresses. That's casper.com/Beck. Promo code Beck. Save $50 off the purchase of select mattresses. Terms and conditions do apply. It's casper.com/Beck.
Glenn Beck. Mercury. Glenn Beck.
Have a fascinating conversation next hour with a guy who can tell you a little bit what the future is going to be like in a very entertaining way. We will take you there next hour.
That's a terrible story, too, about these kids that were chained in the basement. And that's the big story today about this Turpin family. When you were reading the story, did you have a moment at all, like I did, thinking about Hank Johnson? Remember Hank Johnson, the congressman? And so he asked the military guy, do you think if we put too many troops in Guam, you know, the whole thing will, you know, tip over and capsize?
Yeah.
And if you remember his response, it was, we don't anticipate that.
Right. Right.
And there's just something about the way that, like, officials respond to these things that's just in the most serious circumstance is really funny. And so in this one, they went and they interviewed it was a police statement where they were talking about this terrible case, 13, you know, kids, and they're all like chained up in a basement and it's inexplicable. These old, you know, 20-year-olds that look like 10-year-olds because they're so thin. And they asked him what happened. And he said, and the quote was, David and Louise were unable to immediately provide a logical reason why their children were restrained in that matter.
Right.
They were. What would the logical reason
be? I know.
That is such a great quote. They were unable to immediately come up with a logical reason why they changed.
I'll give you time on that. I'll give you a couple hours.
Take
the week. Can you come up with a logical reason to chain your kids to the bed?
I can't come up with it. I gotta say. I mean, let's see. If there was a. You were worried about them escaping because there was a nuclear holocaust outside.
Nope.
No, I don't think that that would work.
You thought they were possessed by the devil. Nope.
No.
They were violent to themselves and others. Nope.
They wanted to be prepared if gravity reversed itself. That could
That could happen.
At any moment.
At any moment, they could be floating up. Well, they wouldn't have floated away if they would have. All they would have to do is close the windows.
Everyone else would have fallen. Well, yeah, that's true. You would have seen the ceiling.
Just close the windows. I got to pull them down from the ceiling again.
Glenn Beck, Mercury. You're listening to the Glenn Beck Program.
This Aziz Ansari story is really where what's going to separate the men from the boys, the revolutionaries from the sane. Margaret Atwood, she's the woman who wrote A Handmaid's Tale. She's been a feminist for forever. She is now, I think, 78 years old. And she wrote this article for The Guardian last week entitled, Am I a Bad Feminist? So I read this yesterday, and I read the whole thing, not just the highlights like everybody else. And I read the whole thing. She said, it seems like I'm a bad feminist, and I can add that to the other things that I've been accused of since 1972, such as climbing to fame up a pyramid of decapitated men's heads. From a lefty journal, being a dominatrix bent on the submission of men, a right one, of being an awful person who can annihilate with her magic white witch powers anyone critical of her at Toronto dinner tables. She said, I'm so scary, aren't I? And now it seems I'm conducting a war on women, like the misogynistic, rape-enabling bad feminist that I am. My fundamental position is that women are human beings with the full range of saintly and demonic behaviors this entails, including criminal ones. Women are not angels incapable of wrongdoing. If they were, we wouldn't need a legal system. Nor do I believe that women are children incapable of agency or making moral decisions. If they were, we're back to the 19th century and women should not own property, have credit cards, have access to higher education, control their own reproduction, or vote. There are powerful groups in North America pushing this agenda, but they're not usually considered feminists. Furthermore, I believe that in order to have civil and human rights for women, there have to be civil and human rights, period. Including the right to fundamental justice. Just as for women to have the vote, there has to be a vote. Do good feminists believe that only women should have such rights? Surely not. That would be a flip of the coin on the old state of affairs, in which only men had those rights. So let me suppose that my good feminist accusers and the bad feminists, that is me, agree on the above points. Where do we diverge? How did I get into such hot water with good feminists? In November 2016, I signed, as a matter of principle, as I have signed many petitions, an open letter called UBC Accountable. This is the University of British Columbia. She goes into how the University of British Columbia treated one of its former employees, Stephen Galloway. He was the former chair of the Department of Creative Writing. He was accused of something. He wasn't even allowed to know what he was accused of. They did this inquiry. They had multiple witnesses and interviews. Finally, a judge said there was no sexual assault. Yet he got fired anyway. His life was destroyed, and she's looking at this going, no, this is not, this is a witch hunt. This is a witch hunt. She said any fair-minded person would withhold judgment as to guilt until the report and the evidence is available for us to see. But this is witch talk, and she talks about going into now these witch trials, and And we've got to stop. We can't have the witch trial justice. Now, another feminist writes, because Margaret Atwood was called a blood-drinking monster, the things that they said about her were just horrendous. So another woman writes, and she says, Margaret Atwood, as an enemy of feminism, is a tough concept to get your head around. She is, after all, the author of The Handmaid's Tale, the universally acclaimed dystopian fantasy in which men are women are enslaved to men. Her impressive body of work, one that has profoundly informed the feminist zeitgeist, is a 50-year-long attack on misogyny and the patriarchal state. Ms. Atwood is probably the leading feminist author in the world. So what happened? Now listen to this. What happened is that the revolution has entered a new phase. Having vanquished the reactionary, the Jacobins are now sending the moderates to the guillotine. Buildings have to be raised so society can begin anew, and everyone who isn't for them is against them. Moderates like Ms. Atwood and their odious ideas about due process and the presumption of innocent until proven guilty are traitors to the revolution. In one letter to the Globe, it put it another way. Revolution isn't about justice. It's about change. This is a frightening thing to behold. We as a society are now starting to go into a new period of this revolution. It was not about justice. It was about change. What did we say in 2007, 2008? Change to what? Change to what? Nobody would ever define the change. And so this revolution now has happened. And now the revolutionaries are taking everyone kicking and screaming. And these are the same people who said George Bush was horrible because he said, if you're not with us, you're against us. That was a horrible thing. That's what they're saying now. And there's this standard that has nothing to do with human rights. It's against human rights. This Aziz Ansari, this story is remarkable. And even Ashley Banfield, who I don't think I've ever agreed with anything she's ever said, she gets on CNN, and I want you to listen to what she said about this.
What you have done, in my opinion, is appalling. You went to the press with the story of a bad date, and you have potentially destroyed this man's career over it, right after he received an award for which he was worthy. If you were sexually assaulted, go to the cops. If you were sexually harassed, jeopardizing your work, speak up and speak out loud. But by your own descriptions, that is not what happened. You had an unpleasant date and you did not leave. That is on you. And all the gains that have been achieved on your behalf and mine are now being compromised by the allegations that you threw out there. And I'm going to call them reckless and hollow. I cannot name you publicly and sentence you to a similar career hit as Ansari because you chose to remain anonymous. Lucky you.
Wow. Wow. I mean, geez, if a guy said that, their career would be over, right?
Oh, if a guy said that?
Mm-hmm.
Let me give you some other things. You know, babe.com is the rag that put this charge out.
Right. From the unnamed source.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Who had a bad date. Explain exactly what happened.
They went to his apartment, started the date at the apartment. They had met at a party, and she was impressed by his celebrity. I mean, he's a, mm-hmm. if you don't know who he is, he's a comedian. He does the show Master of None on Netflix, among other things. And so they went to his apartment. At one point, he offered her a glass of wine, and he brought her white wine. And in the article, it was an interesting, revealing moment where she says, it was white wine. Of course, I prefer red. Like, as if she couldn't say, can I have some red wine? it was like he was forcing her to accept this white wine, even though she preferred red. And it's like such a strange detail to put in there, just showing that
if it is true that he didn't want you to have white wine and you said, oh, no, I prefer white, she'll have the red. That should have been the end of the date right there.
Right. And that's not what happened. She didn't even express by her own telling that she actually wanted red wine. She just accepted the white wine. And again, it's another part of she has no agency. She's not a person. She's, you know, she is an underling in society. She can't make her own decisions. She can't express her own wants and desires. So they go out. They have a quick date. They go through, as she puts it, they rush through a dinner at a fancy restaurant. Now, so far, this guy's given her wine and he's brought her to a fancy restaurant. There's no indication he's been a jerk to her in any way. They get back. They start kissing. They eventually perform oral sex on each other.
Which she said she was uncomfortable with. Okay. But then she left. She came back and they did it again.
Right. And so she claims through this, she gave nonverbal cues that which should have told him to stop. At one point, she did say something like, I kind of want to take it slow when it came to the final act. Right. Like it seemed like by her description, she had drawn some sort of line that she didn't want to go all the way that night. And she tried at one point. She said, let's take it a little slow. They stopped. They started up again. And it got close to that point again. She decided, you know, I don't want to do this. And she left. He did not say, no, you will do this. I demand it. When she asked to slow down, he slowed down.
And she left.
And he was so sure that this was a consensual, fine evening, even though he wanted to have sex with her and she decided to stop it at one level. That the next day he texted her and said, hey, it was really nice meeting you last night. I had a great time. And then she responded with this 100 word text of, I did not feel fine and here's why. And she was very upset. He responded and said, oh my God, I had no idea you felt that way. I'm really sorry if you felt that way. I feel terrible. And that was it until she decided to write an article anonymously about the incident.
Rupert Murdoch put $6 million into Babe. He was one of the first big investors of Babe. Hmm. The average writer is about 25 years old, female. Now, you said a minute ago, imagine if a woman or a man said what Ashley Banfield just said.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let me give you a couple of the stories, and I can't read very much of these stories because they're absolutely pornographic. Okay. Carolyn Finney. The headline is How to Trap Your Man Who Doesn't Know He's Your Man, but is Still Your Man Before Valentine's Day.
Okay. Hmm.
How to trap. Now imagine if I said, hey, I'm going to write an article about how to trap that woman who doesn't know she's your girlfriend, but she's your girlfriend until Valentine's Day.
Yeah, the men writing articles about trapping women, it doesn't go over that well, typically.
Yeah, yeah. Cuffing season is officially over, which means your current victim is crafting a convenient excuse to leave you before the big day of Valentine's Day. Your current victim. Imagine I write that.
Mm. Writing that you have female victims, not usually, looked upon kindly.
Kindly, right.
When men write that.
And who can blame them? Now listen to this. Who can blame them? You know you're manic, but you thought your game would make up for it. Nevertheless, 3 to 5 meltdowns and half a breakup later, he's weary and you're mad. And he's still not sure why you think you're dating him in the first place. This is only one.
The stuff you can't read, which you read to me, and I'm internally scarred from you reading to me today.
It's just it's stunning.
Yeah, it is stunning. And it's what's amazing about it is it's all written from this perspective of, oh, gosh, we're feminists. We can do anything. We're in control of our sexuality. Look at us. And then she can't say no to red wine at the same time.
This talks about how you trap a man in bed. How you get him to do what you want him to do by fooling him and trapping him.
Mm-hmm.
So please don't lecture the rest of us on how to behave. Because if my daughter if I behaved this way, forget my daughter, if I behaved the way you are condoning and encouraging, you would have the right to describe me as a despicable human being.
And by the way, babe.net is the site.
Yeah, okay.
Don't try the other one.
Oh, don't try the other. Okay, sorry about that. Whoops. Blinds.com, the best at what they do. Blinds.com, Marlene from Ohio. She said this, Blinds.com is by far the most customer-friendly company I have ever experienced. The customer service representatives are knowledgeable about the products. They take a lot of time helping me with my selection of even just the color. The blinds were easy to install. They look beautiful. The quality is excellent. I highly recommend Blinds.com. Don't take it from me. I've told you for years how great they are, how great the service is. Stu has used them. He put shutters in his house and had exactly the same kind of experience. In fact, didn't they downsell you? Didn't they?
Yeah, they actually downsold me from the, I guess I was looking at the, of course, my wife was choosing it. So yeah, we were going to go with the top of the line. What a stunning surprise that was. Yeah. And they said, actually, this other kind is the same quality and maybe even a little bit better. And it's actually cheaper. You should try that one, which we did. And they were amazing. They were totally right.
Yeah. So their service is great. Their product is great. Their prices are great. What are you waiting for? Go to blinds.com right now. Blinds.com/Beck. Right now through January 28th, you're going to save 20% site-wide at blinds.com/Beck. Rules and restrictions do apply.
Glenn Beck, Mercury. Glenn Beck.
See, there's a new app out now that allows you to create a consent contract before you sleep with somebody.
I like this. This is now we can all have it all official.
Yeah. You just, you know what? Sign here, initial this, and sign, and I'm hot and ready to go now.
It's not sexy, but also, aren't you giving away? Like, can you imagine if you actually got really assaulted after this? The person would have a legally binding contract saying you agreed. That would not, well, that's not a good move.
That'd be a form contract. The long Beck, extended version.
Mercury. Love. Courage. Truth. Glenn Beck.
You know, Sweden is a fantastic country. It is a country that is known as the most refugee friendly country in the world, and that is something that they are very proud of, and something that they really lived in World War II, and they're living it now. When you go to Sweden, if you're an immigrant, you're given free housing, money, language lessons, even a salary while you search for a job. They are leading the world in tolerance and acceptance, or so you would think. They are leading the world unless you're a Christian. There is a shocking story coming out of Sweden now that is kind of being buried, of Adine Stranson. She was a popular TV and movie actress in her home country of Iran. One day, she witnessed a woman getting stoned to death, and she thought, I got to get out of here. Not long after, she had a dream. It was a dream of Jesus, and she decided that she wanted to convert, but she had to do it in private, in secret, because in Iran, converting to Christianity is deadly. So she left for Sweden. Because Sweden was taking in immigrants and refugees, she decided to immigrate on a work visa. When she got to Sweden, it's when she decided to make her conversion public, to not live a lie anymore. Leaving the Islamic faith is illegal in Iran, punishable by death. But Swedish immigration recently has decided now to deny her asylum request and block her from getting a job. The UN and Swedish immigration policy states that an immigrant cannot be denied asylum if the seeker faces imminent danger upon arrival back at their home country. She was a public figure. She's getting death threats. If she's deported back to Iran, she will face imprisonment, rape, and execution. Why? Because of her faith. kind of an odd story from the most tolerant and accepting society on the planet. I don't know what's happening to Sweden. Given the recent investigation done by the Swedish newspaper, they uncovered the program what the Swedish government was running to protect ISIS terrorists arriving from Syria. Apparently, these poor jihadists were having a hard time finding jobs because their pictures and starring roles in propaganda videos were scaring off employers. Imagine that. So the Swedes did an undercover operation and fixed all that with brand new identities and protected status. What the hell is, what are we doing? I don't care what faith you're in. If you're being persecuted by your because of your faith, we need to protect you. But if you're being persecuted because you're a starring role in a terrorist recruiting film, I don't get it. There is a global war being waged right now. And in some places, like here in the United States, the war on faith is being fought against ideology. In other places like Iran, the war is literally life and death. We've come full circle in the Middle East, a return to the first century. And like then, the time has come to show the world that a church is meaningless. A church is how you behave. It's more than brick and mortar. It's not a place. It is a state of being. I don't know what it means to be a Christian, quite honestly, anymore. It's supposed to change us. But a church is about people, and millions of Christians and Yazidis and even Muslims who aren't Muslim enough live under the constant threat of persecution and death. It is time we all stand shoulder to shoulder without any ill will or hatred in our hearts, and we stand with them, because never again is now.
It's Tuesday, January 16th. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
I have been immersing myself in future tech to try to understand what is coming our way and what the moral issues are of the near future. What it means to each of us in our lives, what it means to be asked the question, am I alive? Is this life? We have so many questions that we have to answer, and we're having trouble with just some of the basic things, and no one is really thinking about the future. When you think about the future and you think about robots or you think about AI, Americans generally think of the Terminator. Well, that's not necessarily what's going to happen. How do we educate our kids? So I've been reading a lot of high-tech stuff, and I've, in my spare time, been trying to read some novels. And I'm looking for the storytellers, the people who can actually tell a great story that is really based in what is coming. The futurist or the near future sci-fi authors that can show us what's on the horizon. And I found a series of books. It's called the Singularity series. And I found them over the Christmas vacation, and I just last night finished the fourth one. And they are really, really well done. They get a little dark, but it also shows the positive side of what could be. And it was a balanced look and a way to really understand the future that is coming and is on the horizon. William Hertling is the author, and he joins us now. William, how are you, sir?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me on.
Congratulations on a really good series. This is self-published?
Yep, it is self-published. I could not find a publisher who saw the vision of the series, but I've self-published it, and people love it. So get the word out there.
Yeah, you've won several awards for it, and I hope I don't know what your sales have been like, but I hope your sales are really good. because I think it, well, let me ask you this. What was the intent of the series for you?
The, you know, what happened was about 10 years ago, I read two books back to back. One was Ray Kurzweil's The Singularity Is Near, mm-hmm. Which I know you've read as well.
Yep.
And the other one was Charles Strauss's Accelerando, which is a fictional book about the singularity. And what I realized at that point in time was that we had the biggest set of changes that were ever going to face humanity, and they were coming, and they were in the very near future, right? They're certainly coming in my lifetime. They're probably coming within the next 10 years, and there's very little out there about that. And as you said, most of the stories that are in media today are about these Terminator-style stories. AI, rise up, they take control over the machines, and we fight them in a battle, which, of course, makes for a great movie. I mean, I would love to see the Terminator many times over, but what happens when it's not like that? What happens when it's sort of the quiet AI kind of story? And that's really what I wanted to explore. What happens when there's this moment of emergence of the first AI that's out there and people realize they're being manipulated by some entity, and what do they do about it? How do they react?
So I find this, first of all, you lay it out so well, and you start, the first book starts with the emergence of AI, and then moves, I think the next book is what, 10 years later, 5 years later?
They're all 10 years apart, yeah. So you can basically explore different points in technology in the future.
Right. So the last one is in the 2040s or 2050s, and it's a very different thing than it starts out as. The thing I wanted to talk to you about is, first of all, can you just define, because most people don't know the difference between AI, AGI, and ASI, which is really important to understand.
Sure. So AI is out there today. It's anytime programmers write a piece of software that instead of having a set of rules, you know, if you see this, then do that. Instead, the AI software is trained to make decisions on its own. So AI is out there today. It's how you have self-driving cars. It's what selects the stories that you read in Facebook. It's how Google search results come about. And AGI is this notion that artificial intelligence will become more general, right? All of those things I mentioned are very specific problems to be solved. How to drive a car is a very specific problem.
A good explanation of AI would be Big Blue, the chess playing IBM robot. It has no general intelligence. It does that.
Exactly.
Right. Okay.
Right. And we have IBM's Watson, which is really good at making diagnoses about cancer, but you can't have a conversation about how you're feeling.
Right.
But AGI would. AGI would appear to be like a human being, conceivably, in that it could talk and reason about a wide variety of topics, make decisions, generally use its intelligence to solve problems that it hasn't even seen before.
Now, AGI can pass the Turing test?
Yeah, so the Turing test is this idea that you've got a person in one room chatting with someone in another room, and they have to decide, is that a human being or is it a computer? And if they can't figure it out, then that is the Turing test. And that you've passed the Turing test if you can't distinguish between a computer and a person.
How close are we to that?
Well, I think we've probably all been fooled at least a few times when we've either gotten a phone call or made a phone call and we think that we're talking to a human being on the other end, right? But it actually turns out that we're talking to a machine that routes our phone call somewhere. So, you know, we're there for like a couple of sentences, but we're still pretty far away if you're going to have any kind of a meaningful conversation.
And AGI is when a computer has the computing power of a human brain.
Yep.
Okay. Now, that's not necessarily a scary thing, but it's what happens when you go from AGI to ASI, artificial superintelligence, and that can happen within a matter of hours, correct?
It can. There's a couple of different philosophies on that. But if you can imagine that think about the computer that you have today versus the computer you had 10 years ago, right? It's vastly more powerful than the one you had 20 years ago. So even if there's not these super rapid accelerations in intelligence, even if you had just today had a computer that was the intelligence of a human being, you would imagine that 10 years from now, it's going to be able to think about vastly more stuff much faster, right? So we could see even just taking advantage of increasing in computing power, we would get a much smarter machine. But the really dangerous, or not necessarily dangerous, the really rapid change comes from when the AI can start making changes to itself. So if you have today programmers create AI, but in the future, AI can create AI. And the smarter the AI gets, then in theory, the smarter the AI it can build. And that's where you can get this thing that kind of spirals out of control.
So you get a handle on how fast this can all change. If you have an Apple iPad 2, that was one of the top five supercomputers in 1998. Okay, that was a top five supercomputer. That's how fast technology is growing on itself. All right, so William, I want you to kind of outline, we're going to take a break, and I want you to come back and kind of outline why all of this stuff matters. What is in the near future that we're going to be wrestling with, and why people should care? When we come back, we have a burglary in America about every 8 seconds. And you know what really thwarts them is somebody who has a security system. They find generally houses that aren't protected. That's why securing your home is a necessity. But a security system can be really expensive. And if you go the old-fashioned way, you don't ever own it. You're always paying on it. And, you know, you're charged $50 and $60 for the 24/7 monitoring. It's just really ridiculous. So SimpliSafe has a new, much smarter system. Its sensors are going to protect every point of access in your home. If a burglar just even breaks the glass or tries to open anything, the sirens go off that will allow, you know, let them know, hey, police are on the way. Police have been called. But it also will take a picture of whoever it is that was trying to break in that you can give to the police when they arrive. SimpliSafe has 24/7 monitoring at $14.99 a month. They never lock you into a long-term contract, and you own the system. Plus, you get a 60-day money-back guarantee, so there's no reason not to try it. SimpliSafe, the security system that you should have in your home, SimpliSafeBeck.com. Go there now, SimpliSafeBeck.com.
Glenn Beck, Mercury. Glenn Beck.
As you know, if you're a long-term listener of the program, I am very fascinated with the future and what is coming, the future of tech and artificial intelligence. William Hertling is an author and a futurist. He is the author of what's called the Singularity series. It's a series of four novels that kind of break it down and tell you exactly what's coming and break it down in an entertaining fashion. I highly recommend the Singularity series. If you are interested in any of this, you need to start reading that. You will really enjoy it.
William, I know Glenn is a big fan of your work and has been reading a lot about technology. I think a lot of people who are living their daily lives aren't as involved in this. You know, I think a third or a half of the audience, when you hear AI, don't even, you know, even connect that to artificial intelligence until you say it. I know as a long-term NBA fan, I think Allen Iverson, honestly, when I hear AI. So can you make the case of, with everything going on in the world, why should people put this at the top of their priority list?
Well, it's the scale of the change that's coming. And probably the nearest thing that we're really going to see is over the next 5 years, we're going to see a lot more self-driving cars and a lot more automation in the workplace. So I think transportation jobs account for something like 5% of all jobs in the United States. And whether you're talking about driving a car, a taxi, driving a delivery truck. All of those things are potentially going to be automated, right? This is one of the first really big problems that AI is tackling, and AI is good at it. So AI can drive a car, and it can do a better job. It doesn't get tired. It doesn't go out and drink before it drives, and it doesn't make mistakes. Well, that's not quite true. It's going to make mistakes, but it's going to make less mistakes than your typical human operator. So it's, business likes to save money, and it likes to do things efficiently, and self-driving cars are going to be more cost-effective. They're going to be more efficient. So what happens to those 5% of the people today who have transportation jobs, right? This is probably going to be the biggest thing that affects us.
I think, William, that Silicon Valley had better start telling the story in a better fashion, because as these things hit, we all know politicians on both sides. They'll blame somebody. They're telling everybody that I'm going to bring the jobs back. The jobs aren't coming back. In fact, many, many more are going to be lost, not to China, but by robotics and AI. And when that happens, I can see, politicians turning and saying, it's these robot makers. It's this AI people.
Yeah, naturally. And yet, unfortunately, the AI genie is out of the bottle, right? Because we're investing in it. China's investing in it. Tech companies around the world are investing in it. If we stop investing in it, even if we said, hey, we don't want AI, we don't like it, all that's going to do is put us at a disadvantage compared to the rest of the world. So it's not like we can simply opt out. It's not really, we don't have that option. It's moving forward. So we need to participate in it, and we need to shape where it's going. And I think this is the reason why it's so important to me that more people understand what is AI and why it matters, because we need to be involved in a public conversation about what we want society to look like in the future.
I think
as we go out, if even more jobs are eliminated by AI, what does that mean? What if we don't have meaningful work for people?
I think that the thing I like about your book series is it starts out really hopeful, and it shows that, this technology is not going to be something that we really are likely to refuse, because it's going to make our life incredibly stable and easy in some ways. And I'd kind of like you to talk a little bit about, the stock market and the economy and war and everything else, something that you talk about in your first novel, and show you, when we come back, the good side, and then what it could turn into.
So Allen Iverson is taking our transportation jobs?
Yes.
Okay, that's what I got from that.
Glenn Beck, Mercury. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
We're talking to William Hertling. He is the author and futurist, the author of many books. His latest is The Kill Process. But I'm talking to him about the Singularity series. And the first one in there is the Avogadro Corp. And it is it starts out around this time, and it starts out with a tech center in Portland. And a guy is working on a program that will help everybody with their email. And all of a sudden, he makes a couple of changes. And unbeknownst to him, it grows into something that is thinking and acting and changing on its own. And William, I'd like you to take us through this, because the first book starts out really kind of positive, where you're looking at this and there's some spooky consequences. But you're looking at it and going, I can see us. I'd kind of like that. And by the end, and the fourth book, we have all been digitized and we're in a missile leaving the solar system because Earth is lost. Do you think this is this your prediction, or you just think this is a really kind of good story?
I think a lot of it has the potential to be real. And I think one of the things you probably know from my reading is that I'm fairly balanced in what I see as both the risks and the benefits.
Right.
I think there's both. I get very upset. There's so many people that are very dogmatic about artificial intelligence in the future, and they either say, hey, it's either all benefits and there are no risks, where they only talk about the risks without the benefits.
Yeah.
And, you know, and there's a mix of both. And it's like any other technology, right?
We
all
don't know.
Love our smartphones. We all find our smartphones to be indispensable. And at the same point in time, they affect us, right? And they have negative effects. And society is different today than it was 10 years ago.
But this,
because of our smartphones.
This is different, though, than anything else that we've seen, like a smartphone, because this is like a, you know, an alien intelligence. We don't have any way to predict what it's going to be like or what it's going to do, because it will be thinking, and it most likely will not be thinking like a human. But can we start at the beginning, where just give me some of the benefits that are going to be coming in the next, you know, let's say 10 years that people are going to have a hard time saying no to?
Sure. I mean, first of all, we already talked about self-driving cars, right? I think we'd all like to get into our car and be able to do whatever we want to do and not have to think about driving. And that's going to free us up from a mundane task. We're going to see a lot more automation in the workplace, which means that the cost of goods and services is going to go down. So we're going to be able to get more for less. So that's going to seem like an economic boom to those of us that can afford it, right? We are going to enjoy more things. We are going to have better experiences when we interact with AI. So today, if you have to go to the doctor, you're going to wait to get a doctor's appointment. You're going to go in. You're going to have this rushed experience, more than likely, at least here in the U.S., right? And you're going to get 5 minutes of their time, and you're hoping that they're going to make the right diagnosis in that 5 minutes that they're with you. That's going to be, I think, one of the really big changes over 5 to 10 years from now, is we're going to see a lot more AI-driven diagnosis. So when you're having medical issues, you can go in and you can talk to an AI that'll be more or less indistinguishable from talking to the nurse when you walk into the doctor's office. And by the time the doctor sees you, there'll already be a diagnosis made by the AI, and it'll likely be more accurate than what the doctor would have done. And all they're going to do is sign off on it.
Yeah, I had a hard time until I started reading about Watson. I had a hard time believing that people would accept something from a machine, but they are so far ahead of doctors if they're fed enough information. They're so far ahead on, you know, predicting cancer and diagnosing cancer than people are. I think it's going to be a quick change. You're going to want to have the AI diagnose you.
Right, because that's going to be the best, right? When
right.
we go to the doctor, we want the best. We don't want the second best. So we're going to see a lot of that. And then, you know, 10, 15 years out, we start, and you know, it's funny. I had a conversation with my daughter one day, and she asked, "Hey, Dad, when am I going to get to drive a car?" And I thought about her age, and I thought about that, and I was like, "Well, I'm not sure you're ever going to get to drive a car, because you know where you are and when self-driving cars are coming. You may never drive a car, and so you'll just get in one, and it'll take you where you want to go. So there's going to be these very sort of, they're both subtle and yet dramatic changes in society when you think about, hey, we're going to have a generation of people who may never learn how to drive a car, right? Their time will be freed up to do other things. But they'll be different than we are.
Do you see the, you know, in your first book, you talk about, AI changing, you know, the emails that are being sent and doing things on its own and really manipulating people. We are already at the point to where we accept the manipulation of what we see in our Facebook feed, but that's not that's not a machine trying to do anything but give us what we want.
Right.
Do you see us very far away from hedge fund computers that can really manipulate the markets in a positive way, or computers that can begin to manipulate for peace, as you put in your book, your first one?
It's a good question. We're definitely going to see that. We're going to, at least at a minimum, right, where we can imagine that if you have an authoritarian government, they're going to distribute information to pacify people. And that's not a good thing often, but in some ways it is. I mean, you know, if you have armed unrest, people will die. So there's a balance there. I think what we're going to see is we're just going to see lots of different people using technology in lots of different ways. So maybe we don't have a hedge fund manipulating the markets in a positive way. Maybe it starts with a bunch of hackers in another country manipulating the markets to make money, right? But I think we are going to see that distribution, that manipulation of information. And it's hard. It's out there now, right? There's content, a lot of the content that you read on the web, whether it's a review of a restaurant or a business, mm-hmm. a lot of that is already generated by AI. And it's hard to tell what's an AI versus a person
writing
a genuine review.
Talking to William Hertling, he's an author and futurist, author of a great series of novels called The Singularity Series. William, the idea that intelligent, not AI, not narrow AI, but, you know, super intelligence or artificial general intelligence just kind of comes out of nowhere, as it does in your first novel, where it wasn't the intent of the programmer, is interesting to me. I sat with a bigger name from Silicon Valley just last week, and we were talking about this, and he said, whoever controls AI, whoever gets this first, is going to control the world. He was talking to me privately about a need for almost a Manhattan Project for this. Do you see this as something that's just going to be sprung on us, or will it be taken, you know, in a lab intentionally?
I think the odds are probably strongly biased towards in a lab, both because they have the kind of deeper knowledge and expertise, and also because they have the kind of raw computing power, right? So the folks at Google are going to have millions of times more computing power than someone who's outside of a company like Google. So that alone, it's like they have the computers that we'll have in 15 to 20 years, right? That kind of computing power. And that makes AI a lot easier of a problem to solve. So I think it's most likely to come out of a lab.
If you're looking at, for instance, the lawsuit that was just filed with against Google about the way they treat people with different opinions, et cetera, et cetera, my first thought is, good God, what are those people putting into the programming? I mean, that doesn't work out well for people. Are there enough people that are concerned about what this can do and what this can be that we have the safeguards with people?
You know, I really think we don't. I mean, think about the transportation system we have today and the robust set of safety mechanisms we have around it, right? So we want to drive from one place to another. We have a system of streets. We have laws that govern how you drive on those streets. We have traffic lights. Cars have anti-lock brakes. They have traction control. All these things designed to prevent an accident. If you get into an accident, we have all these harm reduction things, right? We have seat belts and airbags and crumple zones. And after the fact, we have all this, we have a whole system of mitigation, right? We have ambulances and paramedics and hospitals to take care of what damage does result. And in the future, we're going to need that same sort of very robust system for AI. And we don't have anything like that today.
And nobody's really thinking about it,
nobody's thinking about it comprehensively. And one thing you could imagine is, well, we'll wait until we have a problem, and then we'll put those safety mechanisms in place. Well, the problem, of course, is that AI operates at the speed of computers, not at the speed of people. And there's a scene in one of my books, I'm sure you remember reading it, where there's a character who witnesses a battle between two different AI factions.
Yes.
And the whole battle takes place, a lot of things happen between the two different AI factions, all in the time it takes the human character's adrenaline to get pumping. And by the time he's like primed and ready to fight, the battle is over and they're into negotiations and how to resolve it, right?
It's remarkable in reading that. That is a great understanding of how fast this will, things will move. It's like one of the best action novels of war scenes I've ever seen. Really, really good, you know, page after page after page of stuff happening. And you get to the end and you realize, oh, my gosh, the human hasn't even hardly even moved. He hasn't even had a chance to think about the first step that happened, and it's already over.
Exactly. So this is why we need to be thinking about how are we going to control AI? How are we going to safeguard ahead of time? We have to have these things in place long before we actually have AI.
Isn't it true, though, William, that eventually some bad actor is going to be able to develop this and not put those safeguards in, and we're not going to have a choice? Eventually, the downside of this is going to affect everybody.
You know, it's very true, and part of the reason why I say, right, we can't opt out of AI. We can't not develop it, because then we're just at a disadvantage to anyone who does. And it gets even scarier as you move out. So one of the things that I talk about in my third book, which is set in around like 2035, and that's I talk about neural implants. I think neural implants, so basically a computer implanted in your brain, the purpose of which is mostly to get information in and out, right? So instead of having a smartphone in our hand where we're trying to read information on the screen, we can get it directly in our head. It makes the interaction much smoother, easier. But it can also help tailor your brain chemistry, right? And so if you could imagine, if you're someone who has depression or anxiety or a severe mental disability, that a neural implant could correct for those things. So, right? So you would basically be able to flip a switch and turn off depression or turn off anxiety.
William, I'm wow. Unfortunately out of time. Could I ask you to come back tomorrow and talk and start there? Because that's really the third book. Start with the neuro implants and where it kind of ends up with technology, because it is remarkable. And in reading the real science behind it, it's real. It's real.
It sure is.
Yeah.
It's coming.
Could you come back maybe tomorrow?
Sure. I'd be happy to.
Okay, great. Thanks so much, William. William Hertling, author and futurist. He is the author of the Singularity series.
You should get one of those things, Glenn. The that thing that'll alter your brain. William Hertling is the author of all of these books. There's four of them in this series, and in the Singularity series, plus Kill Process just came out. That's williamhertling.com. Let me ask you this, Glenn. Is this the right way to think about it? This comes in from Twitter, at World of Stew. To understand the difference between AI, artificial intelligence, and AGI, artificial general intelligence. So if there's a self-driving car, and it's AI, you say, take me to the bar, and it says, calculating route, beginning travel. Okay. If you say it to AGI, take me to the bar, it responds, your wife says you drink too much, and my sensors indicate you've put on a few pounds, routing to the gym.
I have a feeling you're exactly right.
That's terrible.
All right, let me tell you about Car Shield. I love my truck. I have two old trucks. One I think is 2008 and 2012 or 14. And you know, the 2008 is starting to have some sensor problems, et cetera, et cetera. And you know, when these things start to happen, it's way out of warranty, but I have the extended vehicle service protection from CarShield, so I can still take it into the mechanic, whether it's, you know, the guy at the dealership or just a mechanic, and they get them paid. So it's, I don't have to wait for a check or anything else, and I'm not afraid every time I take that truck in to have it serviced, because just, you know, one little sensor, it could be $1,000, new fuel pump, $500, water pump, $1,000. If you need repairs to your car, and we all do, it's all going to happen, they have a plan now that will cover everything from, you know, the water pump to the car's computer. Car Shield, the ultimate in extended coverage, and they get the mechanic paid, so you don't have to pay out of your pocket. Sign up today, get 24/7 roadside assistance and a rental car when yours is in the shop. Do yourself what I do, save yourself from high repair bills. Get covered with Car Shield. Call 1-800-CAR-6100, mention the promo code Beck, or visit carshield.com and use the code Beck, and you'll save 10%. That's carshield.com, promo code Beck. Deductible may apply.
Glenn Beck, Mercury. Glenn Beck.
We will, I'll post and tweet the links to William Hertling's books. It's really, I've been looking for somebody who can really explain in an entertaining way through a novel what's coming our way. Tomorrow we have another author, one of my favorite authors, is going to be on with us. He's got a similar novel, and we'll talk to him as well. More with William Hertling tomorrow.
Love. Courage. Truth. Glenn Beck.
Good news and bad news. Which do you want to hear first? According to researchers at the University of London, it doesn't really matter which one you hear first. Good news or bad news, which it doesn't matter. You're more likely to believe the good news on something called the desirability bias. Desirability bias is when you consider information more credible because it makes you feel good. It helps explain the whole social media fake news phenomena. When you see something, it's not confirmation bias. It's desirability bias that is actually more difficult and more troubling. Researchers at the University of London set up a study just before the 2016 presidential election, and they took 900 voters who were diehard Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump fans, and they asked them, which one do you support? And which one is going to win? Researchers then separated the voters into the two groups. They gave the first group polling results that indicated that Trump would win, and the second group resulting in Hillary's win. With this new information, they were asked, who do you think is going to win? The result of the study was clear. The desirability bias changes people's minds. People believed the polling results that were given only when their poll indicated that their candidate would win. They would even change it if their candidate was shown to be winning in a strong poll. Even if they thought they were Clinton might win, they changed it and they dug their heels in. So what does all of this mean? It means that we are listening to the things that let us believe the things we want to believe. The lesson for politics is really clear, and it's something that is a lost art now on both sides of the aisle. If you want to persuade people, you have to get them to want to agree with you. This is the biggest problem now. People become monsters and pariahs, and they and strident, and so nobody wants, you don't like them, you don't want to agree with them. Reagan was a guy who really understood this. He was called the great communicator. He won 49 states in the 84 election, and that's because he said things that people wanted to believe. Now we can't fathom a candidate appealing across the aisle. In fact, I think if you see a candidate that tries to appeal to the other side, you immediately mark them as a traitor. We saw Obama supporters blinded by the desirability bias for 8 years. They would not believe reports about the IRS, that he was using the IRS, because they didn't want to believe that. Now we're seeing the same thing with the Trump base. We have to move past this concept of the presidency as the ultimate bully pulpit. It's not what the executive office was designed to be, and it will not help heal our divisions.
It's Tuesday, January 16th. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
Well, we have some really good news to share with you here in just a second. We have Tim Ballard, the founder and CEO of Operation Underground Railroad and the chairman of the Nazarene Fund. And Jessica Mass, she is the director of aftercare for Operation Underground Railroad. And I want to welcome you guys. And we have some exciting stuff to talk about here that happened last week in a very ironic sort of way. But I want to start with the Turpin family in California. how prevalent is, I mean, people were living right on top of this house. They were just feet away. Nobody knew. And it had been going on for a long time. 13 children in this house chained and living in squalor. Wow. Is this common?
You know, it's more common than I think people want to believe. You know, the whole thing of human bondage and human captivity, people want to, in this country, want to put it far, far away from us. There's hundreds of thousands of people, children, in the United States that are in captivity in one form or another. A lot of times it's sexual captivity. And it's just, it's an eye opener for everybody to look around. I mean, this neighborhood, you saw the houses, they were right next to each other.
Yeah. And it was a nice neighborhood.
And it wasn't even a huge house. And 13 kids are chained to beds. And I mean, it's just insane, but it's not something that's shocking to me.
Any, have you ever seen anything like that, Tim? Cause this is what you've done for your whole life.
Yeah, I have. Yeah. We've seen things like that. Throughout our careers, absolutely.
What is usually the motivation?
You know, it's usually tied to something in a sex crime. It's usually child pornography being made, you know, people coming over. We're still looking to see what in the world, no matter what, it's going to be a crazy intent, whatever the intent was. But what was it? What were they getting out of this? I don't know yet.
So, Jess, you have been around. What you do is try to heal people like this. 29 years old. They thought that they were young teenagers because they were so emaciated. Does that 29-year-old have any chance of life?
Well, my belief and based on my experience is that there's always hope. I have seen people heal through things that they've said there's no hope for, and I've seen people overcome things. So in my personal opinion, I believe that there's always hope, and the journey is really hard, and it's long and painful. But I hope that there are people that will come around this 29-year-old and help them and really walk through that journey with them.
Boy, it's going to be a long road for all of those kids. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about why you guys are here. I've been so excited for this. We have talked about it for a long time, but haven't been able to reveal it. You did a mission in Haiti. As we know, a crap hole of a country. And you did a mission. Oh, how long ago was the first?
It was Super Bowl Sunday of last year.
Yep. Of last year. Okay. And the problem is the system can be corrupt. And in a lot of places in Haiti, it is corrupt. So what happened to the bad guys?
So in this operation, beautifully executed, everything was spot on. And, you know, we were warned, don't work in Haiti. Other NGOs don't work in Haiti because of this system. But you know, Gesno Marty, the father of the boy who was kidnapped, which in Haiti, which is why we were there. And I said, Gesno, I don't know if I can attach our name to, we don't know what's going to happen. There's going to be a corrupt judge potentially. And he says, Tim, if you give up on this operation, you've given up on my son because you've given up on Haiti. And I said, you're right. So we went forward and Glenn, within 10 days, these traffickers were let go, particularly this one, the kingpin, her name was Francois. She holds kids in stables in the darkest parts of this country. And she brought a bunch of these kids with her, young kids. They're making child pornography, porn that was sent into the United States. We got the U.S. authorities involved. And they were let go. They found the right judges. They paid their way out. Over $80,000 they paid and got out. And that phone call broke us. I mean, Jessica and I were talking in the minutes after we found out. We were in tears. I mean, we were just paralyzed. We couldn't believe it.
So then what happened next?
Well, we had a contingency plan, which was dangerous. I didn't want to do it. Mm-hmm. And basically the contingency plan was go into the belly of Port-au-Prince and scream what happened. Tell the media what happened, what really happened. And the Rotary Club of Port-au-Prince supported us. And they said, you need to bring someone of somewhat kind of celebrity status in Haiti or the media is not going to pay attention. And they said, we have an idea for you. Can you get a hold of this of Haitian descent, a U.S. congresswoman named Mia Love?
Yeah.
Have you heard of her, Tim? And I said, are you kidding me?
Like,
not only is she my congresswoman who lives right, like down the street, she's a good friend. I couldn't, it was a miracle. Mm-hmm. I called Mia and I said, look, this is not necessarily a safe approach. And she didn't even bat an eye. She said, are you kidding me? Like, when are we going? Let's go. And we went down to Port-au-Prince. We rented out this conference room. People came from all over. The media was there. And this was the speech we gave. We reminded the Haitians of their history. In 1791, the Haitians did something that no country then or since has done. And that is, it was a slave nation that rose up and pushed its European oppressors out of the country, took the island by force, created a republic, and abolished slavery. The first nation to abolish slavery like this. And what was interesting about this was the American abolitionists were watching this. And when the United States finally eradicated or abolished slavery, at least legally, Frederick Douglass, the great abolitionist, stood up and gave a speech. And he said, "Let us not forget the sons and daughters of Haiti, the true pioneer abolitionists of the 19th century. They inspired this whole movement." So this is the message that Mia and I gave. And people were just rising up. I mean, they were like, and then we said, "Look, you let us out of slavery the first time, do it again." And letting out nine horrible traffickers who are sexually abusing children, you're going in the wrong direction right now. Help us. Let's do this. They rose up. The media went nuts. We got an invitation from the president. And this was another miracle. Is the president of Haiti, Jovenel Moise, he was elected just days after the Super Bowl operation. Mm. So he was able to say, I wasn't part of that. And he wasn't. And so he was easy. It was easy for him to invite us in. I couldn't believe it. We're going into the presidential palace, Mia Love and I. And I just kind of sat back. Mia speaks fluent Creole, you know, and I just watched her work her magic. Oh, yeah. And she got right up in you know, in him and just said, "Look, here's the evidence. Here's what's going on." He says, "I'm not going to stand for this." And I felt it when he said it. You know, you can look in someone's eyes, yes, and know if they, he says, "I, yes, can't believe this. We'll put an end to this." Within a couple of months, we knew the investigation was going. We were supporting it in a lot of ways. We, mm-hmm, had full-time people down supporting, watching. Mm-hmm. And then the news broke. Six judges ripped from the bench. They found the judges who took the bribes. Now, this is unprecedented. I mean,
in Haiti?
In Haiti.
And, this is a big deal.
And the attorney general, who his name was Ocknum, he was instrumental in doing this. I mean, this guy, his team lives in Miami. They can't even live in Haiti for fear, mm-hmm, that their children will be killed, mm-hmm, or their families, you know, mm-hmm, because they are true corruption fighters. Mm-hmm. And they found those judges ripping from the bench, and then they called us and said, "Let's go. Will you come help us? You guys have more intelligence than we do on the whereabouts of these traffickers because you found them all. It was our team that went undercover and found them. Let's go round them up."
So I know I was with you in Haiti a year ago, maybe. And never seen anything like it. And the corruption from the United States, quite honestly, from some of the big charitable organizations that, you know, and the UN that, you know, we're going to help them. No, it's all, the money is not going to the people and where it needs to be. And so we've had these conversations before. And so when you told me what was happening with the president and that he was serious now and he was going to take these people out, it was great news. One of the reasons why I took what the president said last week so personally is because my wife and I had just gotten up off of our knees to pray for you guys because we knew you were doing this operation under the protection of the president of Haiti. Were you already in the operation when you found out what happened?
It was the most awkward moment of any operation I've ever been on. I've been on a lot over my 16-year career. We were sitting in a kind of private restaurant. The attorney general of the country is sitting across the table from me. The chief of police is sitting next to him, and then my operators and we're sitting around and we're talking about this operation. We literally have a recon team out. This woman, Francois, and we'll tell you about that in a second, what happened, how we found her. Once we took her down, she's the kingpin, right? And our recon team's looking for her, and we're just on pins and needles. When are we going to get the call? We're all geared up and ready to go. As soon as he says, you know, our team says, there she is. And there's television screens all around. This is like T-minus 40 minutes.
Oh, jeez.
And boom, I see this. And I see it above their heads, and I'm just reading this. I'm like, no. It says Haiti. No.
Don't turn around.
No,
don't
no.
turn around. Don't turn around.
And again, I wasn't in the room, and I've heard different people say different things.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't know. I'm just telling you my situation.
Yeah.
In this moment, this is the message coming from America to Haiti, and I'm just, you know, and they turned around. They Whoa. Turned around, and they looked at it, and they looked at me, and I didn't know what to... I just was like, so...
So how are things? What... How did you smooth it over?
How I smoothed it over was I just told them, my wife and I, as you know, we're adopting two children from Haiti that we actually rescued in an earlier operation. And these are our kids. I mean, we love them like our own kids. And you know, I just said, you know how much I love, we love your country. We love your country. My children are from your country. My children. And that ended it.
And, have you talked to the president since? Not this president, but the Haitian president?
I have not. We're going down in a couple of weeks to meet with him. He called in, though. He called in to the attorney general just an hour before and just wishing us well and just saying his prayers were with us. I mean, that's also unprecedented, by the way, to have the president of a nation calling in, telling, I'm backing you guys. Yeah. Get these guys. Yeah. Get them out of our country.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to come back in a minute, and he's going to tell you exactly what happened. And then tonight at 5 o'clock, we have video footage of this operation and what it was like on the ground and a lot of stuff that you're going to want to see. You can check that out tonight, 5 o'clock on the Blaze TV. Back in a second with Tim Ballard, founder and CEO, Operation Underground Railroad, and the chairman of the Nazarene Fund. So if you're setting new goals for your business, it is really difficult to reach them without the right people on your team, and that's where ZipRecruiter comes in. They have transformed the way that you can find really good people. ZipRecruiter will not only post your job at over 100 of the leading job boards with one single click, ZipRecruiter then, it's a smart program, and it goes out and it looks for the most qualified candidates and invites them to apply. Hey, I don't know if you've seen this. This is a really great job. You should apply. And that is why 80% of all of the people that use ZipRecruiter, they get a qualified candidate through the site in the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes and industries to find the most qualified job candidate with an immediate result. Right now, ZipRecruiter. Try it for free. ZipRecruiter.com/Beck. That's ZipRecruiter.com/Beck.
Glenn Beck Mercury. Glenn Beck.
Operation Underground Railroad. OurRescue.org and the chairman of the NazareneFund.org is Tim Ballard. He is here to tell us about the operation that happened in Haiti just last week, the day the president was saying what he said about Haiti. It was a really important moment because the president of Haiti was working with Operation Underground Railroad to get some really bad guys. So it wasn't a crap hole. What happened? So you're in that meeting, you get the go. Tell me what.
So we get the go on this, on Francois. I mean, France, she's the kingpin. They want her. She, not only because she has the most kids that she's selling, but because she had paid $80,000 to certain government officials that they didn't know who they were. And these guys want to clean up their country. The president, the attorney general, they wanted her to find out, who did you give that money to that got all your minions out of jail? So they really wanted her.
Do you think she's going to tell? I mean, that's a really dangerous country.
Well, let me tell you what she said when we got her. Glenn, I've never seen this. She said, evil will protect me. I'll never talk. Evil will protect me.
Wow.
I mean, that's the kind of, I've never seen, there's a lot of things on this op I'd never seen before, where she's just like, I'm hand in hand with darkness, and I'm.
She actually said the words?
She actually said that.
Wow.
Yeah. Bizarre. But this woman, she owns a street, essentially. I mean, she sits on one side of the street, all dressed beautifully, you know, with her wig and all this stuff. And these Johns come, and she has all these kids in these stables across the street. I call them stables. I mean, they're these steel doors that close, that lock. They have metal beds that fold down literally where the kids sit, and then a bedroom in the back. And the Johns go in and do their thing. We had been doing surveillance on Francois for about 3 weeks in advance, and we never saw a single child out. It was adults out that she was running. The day we rolled in, and this minute, and this second we roll in, we identify her, and she's swarmed. Well, something happened as we're there's a videographer we have named Justice. I think you've met Justice. Inspired dude. At the last minute, we're driving to the street, to this brothel street. He jumps to the back seat, and in the van, there's three SWAT guys, Haitian SWAT team members, who they're going to come out of the back, back of the van.
Yeah.
He jumps back there and starts wrapping duct tape around this guy's helmet and putting on a GoPro camera. I'm like, Justice, what are you doing? He's like, I don't know. This guy needs a camera.
Wow. Like, and you say it's divine providence. We'll find out why when we come back.
Glenn Beck, Mercury. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
We all talk about, if I would have lived back in the day, I would have been an abolitionist. Really? Would you? Because there are more people that are being held as slaves today than in the entire 400-year history of the slave trade. And yet, are we involved? Are we doing things? Are you an abolitionist? I invite you to be an abolitionist by going to ourrescue.org. Abraham Lincoln is on the $5 bill. Once a month, just give $5 and become an abolitionist. If you can afford it, give more. Ourrescue.org and the NazareneFund.org, which is also rescuing the slaves in the Middle East. Tim Ballard is the founder and CEO of Operation Underground Railroad and the chairman of the Nazarene Fund, just returning from Haiti, where there is a big shakeup happening, trying to make their government work and get away from evil. You just rescued a whole bunch of children and caught probably the kingpin.
The kingpin, yes. The kingpin that we had arrested her back in February of last year and bought her way out of jail. We got with the right people, the new president of Haiti, and here we are going in to get her again 2 nights ago.
So you have your photographer is in the back of one of your vehicles.
Yeah, my videographer jumps in the back, and I'm like, Justice, what are you doing? We're about to hit the brothel. And he's like, I got to get a camera on this guy's helmet. So he's wrapping, I'm laughing. I'm like, okay, he's wrapping duct tape around this kind of awkward scene. The guy's like, all right, that's fine. So we get to the spot. The team gets out of the van. There's like three vans that jump out and get around the target and take her down. She's in the middle of selling one of the girls while we do it with a guy who has 1,200 condoms that he holds the bag for her. But these two guys, one with the camera on his helmet, gets out of the van and he's supposed to come with us, but I see him take off the other way. And what had happened was one of the girls, one of the victims, got scared, didn't know what was going on, and ran into what I can call a stable. I mean, it's a stable door. It's a steel door. And she runs into it. He follows her. He says something's not right. He gets in there. And Glenn, in my 16 years, I've never seen this. And I've seen the camera footage of what he captured. I've never seen this. A girl, probably 13 years old. And I would ask people, this is a tough thing to ask people, but who's 13 in your life? You have a daughter. I have a daughter who's 13. Mm-hmm. These are babies, okay? Mm-hmm. He goes in there and catches in the act a man who's raping her in the back bedroom and pulls him off and goes to her rescue. And we caught it all on camera, which will allow us to prosecute the heck out of this guy. I've never seen that. I mean, we've raided so many situations like this, never in the act. And we had not seen kids, by the way, in the 4 weeks leading up to, you know, tracking this woman, because she keeps them so hidden. It was providential. And the fact that Justice, my videographer,
at the last minute,
puts a camera on this guy's helmet for no apparent reason. It was just kind of this strange act.
So you get the madam or the kingpin here of the Haitian slave trade. Is she the kingpin? Is she the or one of them?
She is, according to the Attorney General of Haiti, she is the number one child trafficker that they wanted.
Wow.
The number one.
So you get her, and she says to you, evil will protect me.
Yes.
That's a quote?
It was translated to me, but that's as close as, that's the translation that I got.
I don't think people understand, you know, going to knowing the history of Haiti, at the same time we made a pact with God, the same year, 1791, they made a pact with Satan, a literal pact with Satan. And I think that's one of the reasons why that country has so many problems. They've never really broken that. I think a lot of people might dismiss it now, but I think it's real there. Evil is real there. And people like her to say, evil will protect me, that's what she's talking about. So how do you heal a country like that, Tim?
You know, what you do is you find those of light, and they're there. And it was that very history you're talking about where we brought that to light and said, look, even in that darkness, because that is part of their history. Anyone will tell you. They'll tell you, like, yeah, there's elements that did that. But there was light that came with that, too, that from the beginning that fought it. And it's about finding those. And people like Congressman Mia Love, who came down, and Attorney General Sean Reyes also accompanied us and helped us to bring the light to the country through people like President Moise and the Attorney General Alknam, and then all the aftercare partners we have. I mean, you've been to our safe house.
Jessica is you're the director of the aftercare, and you're one of the most tender-hearted people I know, and I love watching you because you are tender and yet you are a pit bull in those situations because you know where the danger is. How many people did you get out?
There's four.
Four children.
Yeah.
And the one big boss.
Yeah. Well, okay. and four, and then three of her minions went down. We nailed right at the same time.
And they are going to, the president is all over this one.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So, the situation with the children, you've been there so many times. Tell me about what happened on the anniversary of the earthquake and how that tied in. Do you know what I'm talking about? Tim? Do you know
what I'm talking about? Sorry.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So with the four girls, two of them, their parents were killed during the earthquake. And while we were there was when they were rescued, was the anniversary of the earthquake 8 years later. And I was sitting with...
So they've been in that situation for 8 years.
They were kidnapped because their parents were killed in the earthquake. Just like my kids that I'm adopting, the same thing happened. Tens of thousands of kids.
Yeah. People don't understand that the earthquake, we think, oh, well, the Clinton Foundation came down and built some roads. No, well, what people didn't look at is all of the parents that were dead and the kids were kidnapped and they're still slaves. So they've been slaves for 8 years?
The devastation that comes when someone becomes an orphan overnight and the vulnerabilities that are there are ongoing. And yes, these kids have been in this situation for 8 years. And so when you're sitting with a kid that has been through that, their parents killed, they've been trafficked, and she's looking in my eyes and she says, this is the first time I've ever felt like there's hope. And tears start to roll down her face. And she's like, I finally feel like there might be hope that I'll have something for my life. 8 years later, there's the pain and the beauty that go hand in hand in the story because she's been through this for so long. But even this girl feels the hope in that moment.
We started the hour talking about what happened in California, what they found out from those monsters of parents that chained their kids to the beds. And I know because Jessica and I have talked privately about things that she has seen here in the United States. This happens everywhere. This is not a Haitian problem or a Middle Eastern problem or an American problem. It's a human problem. And there is something inside of man that when it goes dark, it goes really dark. And And that's what the Nazarene Fund and Operation Rescue, Operation OUR, is really all about, is rescuing and going into the darkest of dark places. And I don't know how you guys do it. I don't know, Tim, I don't know how you are as full of light as you are after all of the things that you have seen. But you're a miracle, and we thank you. Tonight at 5 o'clock, we're going to have the footage. So you'll see some of the things that we're talking about. And if we have time, I don't know if we'll have time tonight, but we were talking off the air about what's happening in Sweden right now, where Iran is going to be welcoming home one of their own, somebody who is a refugee who left Iran because she saw a woman being stoned in the streets. She was a journalist over in Iran. She left. She went to Sweden. She got a work visa. She was a refugee. They accepted her. Then she announced she felt comfortable enough to say, I'm not a Muslim. I am a Christian. And Swedes turned on her and have revoked her visa and are threatening to send her back. And I don't know what's happening in the world. I mean, it is like evil is protecting its own right now. And we need your help. So if you can help us, please become an abolitionist. And you can do that by going to ourrescue.org, ourrescue.org. More tonight at 5 o'clock. Thanks, guys, for coming in.
Thank you.
Researchers found two serious security flaws in chips used in every PC, server, smartphone, tablet, anything that's been produced. If it has a Intel chip in it, yeah, it's got a backdoor. Who would have thunk it? Hackers can potentially make use of these flaws to steal data stored in memory, including your passwords and your files. This is the biggest flaw that we have found, the biggest backdoor, because it is in almost literally everything. And there's nothing you can do about it right now. Operating system providers, they have released security patches. Okay. Is that really doing the job? 1 in 4 people have already experienced identity theft. And I tell you, that number is going to go up, and it will happen to you. It will happen to your children. Thieves can sell your information on the dark web or get an online payday loan in your name. And LifeLock works to detect those wide-ranging identity threats. If you have a problem, a U.S.-based restoration specialist is going to work to fix it. Nobody can prevent all identity theft or monitor all transactions at all businesses, but LifeLock is the best. Join now, get 10% off with promo code Beck. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK or go to LifeLock.com. Use the promo code Beck, that's Beck, and save 10% now at LifeLock.com.
Glenn Beck, Mercury. Glenn Beck.
You know what I love about living in this this time period is, especially if you saw The Post. Have you seen the movie The Post yet?
I have not seen that yet.
It's really good, worth seeing. But you'll see in that when they release the Pentagon Papers and the New York Times is shut down and they say you can't release anymore. There's no place to go. If the Washington Post doesn't release them, there's no place to go. Government wins. You can't release the papers. It seems so odd that that news couldn't come out, but that's the way it was. The Monica Lewinsky stuff, if it wasn't for Matt Drudge, we may not have known that. The internet changed everything. Back in the 80s, I remember trickle-down economics, and it was always lampooned, and you could make a case, but you could never make a media case because you didn't have control of it. Going around the internet now, Washington Free Beacon. Here's what people said about trickle-down economics and the president's tax plan and what actually happened once it was passed.
It feels like you're relying on this tax cut of the corporations, of the wealthy, to trickle down.
Yeah, Southwest and American Airlines both announcing they're going to give $1,000 bonuses to employees following the tax overhaul.
Wage increases don't follow tax cuts like this.
So the world's largest retailer giving its U.S. employees a bonus, a wage increase, and expanded maternity and parental leave. So you're creating a huge tax cut.
Right.
And you might not get wage growth.
Right.
Capital One Financial, which just confirmed to CNBC that they will raise the minimum wage for all U.S.-based employees at Capital One to $15 per hour.
And anybody who thinks that this corporate tax cut is going to trickle down to lift wages has a staggering ignorance of how public companies function.
Wells Fargo said it would raise its minimum wage to $15 per hour.
I mean, it's amazing.
I love that he's just so sure of himself on that last one.
Well, because you know what? They could be sure of themselves because there wasn't anybody that would have given that information. Back in the 80s, if CBS, NBC, or ABC didn't make those stories about what the companies were actually doing, it didn't happen. I mean, it was like it didn't happen. Now you have enough outlets and you have control of the media yourself to where you can grab those snippets, you can edit those things, and you can show, no, this is exactly what happens. They have no fear. The liberals with trickle-down economics had no fear of this turning around on them because it never has.
Mm.
But now we have the internet.
It's interesting, too, to see these companies take these stands. Normally, companies, even companies that lean right, don't want to take stands that associate themselves with Republicans publicly. But this is such a clear win for companies. And, you know, companies really do this. Yeah, companies really do this. I mean, I think people, they want their employees happy. There might be selfish reasons for it, right? They want their employees happy. They like the PR of saying, hey, we got a bunch of extra money. And, you know, we're going to distribute that to the people who work for us. There are some selfish reasons for it, but who cares? I mean, it's great. It's great that people, you know, are able to make plans, long-term plans now. These are all permanent changes until, I mean, permanent is permanent as they get, with lawmaking, but permanent changes for corporations. And they are able to really plan for their long-term, company's well-being and their employees' well-being. And this is a big change. I mean, It's not the most bold tax plan we've ever seen. It's not.
Imagine what would have happened had they done a flat tax rate.
Oh my gosh!
If they would have done a flat tax rate, can you imagine the money that would have poured into the average family's home?
Oh my gosh! Yeah, I mean, because this is really it was really more of a corporate plan, right? I mean, it was not particularly life-changing when it comes to the individual side. Though, yes. I'll take anything, right? I'll take any dollar amount you want to give me of my own money. I'll willingly accept it and act like you're doing me a favor. For the corporation side, it actually is a really big difference. They no longer have to, I mean, they don't have to make these big changes. There's so many people who said it wasn't going to be a big deal because their effective rate was this low anyway. It's shown to be a big change
deal
for these companies.
A big deal.
Glenn Beck, Mercury.